my disclosure through the clerk of the fact that I'm a policyholder of the appellant in this case, and I understand from the clerk that there's no application or objection to me sitting. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And that's correct for the appellant's vote.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're ready to begin. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
May it please the court, Dan Bennett for NGM Insurance Company and Main Street America Group. This case is about giving meaning to every word in an insurance policy and giving that word its ordinary meaning. The court is asked to examine the missing property exclusion in a business owner's property coverage policy. It is one of first impression in Delaware. The provision reads, "We will not pay for loss of or damage to property that is missing, but there is no physical evidence to show what happened to it, such as shortage disclosed on taking inventory." The issue presented to this court is whether verbal statement or verbal testimony constitutes physical evidence in order to provide coverage under the policy. Essentially, Elegant Slumming is seeking coverage for the loss of $141,000 in jewelry. And all that Elegant Slumming has to indicate what happened to the property is the statement of one of its employees who says, "I threw it out." And even that story has changed over the course of time. It is National Grange's position that the word physical means just that. Something tangible.
Well, when you say just that, suppose you have the thief, the person who stole the jewelry confesses, in a statement that he stole the jewelry. That wouldn't suffice under your theory, would it?
Well, there are, I believe that the reading of the provision,
it's not tangible.
No, it would not.
It would.
That is not physical evidence. But there are differences.
It would require what? The thieves would have to take a picture of themselves stealing the jewelry and leave it?
There are differences, because it's not that you can't include testimony at all. It's that it cannot be the only evidence, that you have to have some physical evidence. And there have been some courts, I will agree.
But how do you have physical evidence of nothing, that is, of something missing?
Well, and that's the whole point. The whole point is that the purpose of the provision in the policy is to protect against, or at least reduce, fraud.
And if talk on that provision, in your reply brief, you bring up the fact that there is a different part of the policy for theft. Is that correct?
Well,
and that it had a limit of $2,500, and it didn't appear to require physical evidence. So the point of my question is, are we really talking about theft as a good analogy to this missing evidence, or are theft and missing evidence treated differently? Because I get the impression that if someone, like a third-party witness, actually saw a theft and knew the perpetrator because of prior relationships, if the third party came in and said, "I saw someone I know steal the jewelry from the clerk," that would be covered under the theft clause, but not the missing evidence. Is that right?
Well, actually, yes and no. There are different limitations with respect to theft, but theoretically, theft in general would be a covered risk under the policy. And it may be a case in which it is missing property for which no physical evidence is submitted. It could fall under that category. There are other limitations with respect to theft. One of those being that in relationship to the theft of jewelry, it's limited to $2,500.
Well, putting the limitation aside, my question is, you said we should look at the language and give it its common sense interpretation. And Justice Jacobs' question supplemented by my question is, if someone actually witnesses a theft, and they're a third-party objective, and the eyewitness identification is ironclad because of prior knowledge, and there's no other evidence, no video of the theft, no fingerprints, are you saying that the insurance company would deny coverage?
I'm saying that if you look at the, I believe it's the Blazier case, actually the Seagull versus Travelers case, that's exactly what happened. And in the Seagulls versus Travelers case, the employee said, I know the property was stolen, but I can't tell you who stole it. And the court said a verbal statement in that instance is not enough, that you have to have some physical evidence of the property being stolen.
Meaning what?
So, once again, that's one situation. But then again, you have the Blazier case saying that when you do have, because the question was posed to the Blazier court as to what happens when you have somebody who says they witnessed theft. And the court in that instance said, well, that may be testimony about physical evidence.
I think it would be helpful if you would tell us what your position is in response to our questions before you start talking about what the cases say.
My point is that the position is going to depend upon the facts of the situation. Well, in the situation where you have an uninterested third party who witnesses a third party making a theft.
You mean a disinterested third party?
Correct. Making a theft, then relying upon the reasoning of the Blazier court, I would say that is about physical evidence. And that testimony, and you would be able to have coverage under
so
that instance.
Eyewitness verbal evidence, as long as it isn't biased, would constitute physical evidence?
But it's about physical.
Yes or no?
Maybe. I mean, it all depends upon what it was that was seen and what it was, what the physical nature of the evidence is.
Witness says, I saw these three men leaving, in the dead of night, breaking into the building and then leaving it and carrying some packages with them.
Carrying the packages, yes.
There were postal receipts in this case, were there not?
There were, but the difference is that that is not physical evidence that shows what happened to the property. That is merely physical evidence that shows that at some point in time, the business had the property in their possession.
Well, how is that different from an inventory? Let's assume that the inventory shows that everything in the closet on day one is these 15 items. And then the court or the store staff open the closet on day two, and there are only 13 items. Doesn't the initial inventory plus that statement that two are missing establish the inventory exception?
No, because that's the whole purpose of the exclusion. The mere that's the example that's given. A mere shortage disclosed on taking inventory does not give rise to coverage if there's no physical evidence to show what happened to the property.
Mr. Bennett.
Sure.
I think both sides agree that, whichever way we come out, we have to start with the language of the policy that's disputed. And this is a long preamble, but let me bear with me for a minute. In this case, the policy says this insurance does not apply to loss or damage caused by or resulting from disappearance or shortage disclosed on taking inventory, comma, where there is no physical evidence to show what happened. In first reading that and thinking about it, my reaction was, gee, this is unclear. And it wasn't so much about physical evidence. That is the word physical, as that is the entire where clause. That is the last, all the words that follow the comma until the end of the sentence. And then, in going through the briefs, one of the parties discussed a policy that was very similar in the Mid-South Sales case, which took the same words but added three, and it became very clear that, or at least much more clear, and that language reads as follows. I'm referring to page 16 of the appellee's brief, bottom of the page. Property that is missing, comma, where the only evidence of the loss or damage is a shortage disclosed on taking inventory, or other instances, those are the new words, where there is no physical evidence to show what happened to the property. Now, my question to you is that language, that is the Mid-South Sales language, what was intended by the language that was employed in this particular case by National Grange? Or was it something else?
It's different, and I believe that the court misquoted the language from the National Grange policy, because the National Grange policy doesn't start out with the with the inventory exclusion and then extend
the Mid-South Sales policy basically is phrased in terms of missing property where there is no physical evidence to show what happened to the property, and clearly uses an inventory shortage as just one example.
Your policy
seems to focus exclusively on the one example as the only exclusion. So I guess you could say there is a difference, but I'm not sure.
There is a difference. The Mid-South exclusion begins with discussing essentially says the only evidence is a shortage disclosed on taking inventory. Okay? And then it says,
or other instances
where there is no physical evidence. Okay. You got two different situations here.
Yeah, but missing the inventory under Mid-South is one instance.
Correct.
And that clause allows for other instances, but the category that all of that falls under is missing property where there's no explanation for the loss.
Correct. But the difference in Mid-South is it does break it down into two instances. And if you look closely, in the instance where it's an inventory shortage, it says the only evidence, which would mean that anything in addition to the shortage on taking inventory would be sufficient.
Mid-South is a broader clause if you look at it literally.
Correct.
Your clause is narrow if you read it literally. That is, it covers only the case of an inventory disappearance. It doesn't apply to loss or damages caused by or resulting from disappearance or shortage disclosed on taking inventory, comma, where there is no physical evidence to show what happened.
No,
it doesn't talk about other
instances. That's not the National Grange provision. The National Grange provision reads, we will not pay for loss or damage to property that is missing, but there is no physical evidence to show what happened to it, such as shortage disclosed on taking inventory.
Okay. So you're saying that it isn't narrower. It's just worded differently, but it means the same thing?
It's worded differently, and it means something different, because it's given a wide grouping of activities, and that is any missing property where there is no physical evidence to show what happened to it, and then provides an example. Whereas the Mid-South exclusion takes the shortage on inventory and basically says no other evidence, and then says or other instances where there is no physical evidence.
I stand corrected.
So it's breaking into two different types.
I did misread that language.
So just remind us, what is the best case or cases that support your position?
Well, I think the best cases are the Westcom case, the CTSC Boston case, especially the CTSC Boston case, because in that one, the court agreed that the only reasonable inference that could be drawn from the statement was that the merchandise was stolen, or that the laptops were stolen. And the court said that is not enough. The fact that you have a verbal statement, and even though you can only reach the conclusion that it's stolen, there's no physical evidence as to what happened to the property. Likewise, in Westcom, the only thing they had was the testimony of the employee. They said that testimony is not enough. You need some physical evidence. And once again, we've mentioned the Seagull case already, where you had an employee who said, I know who stole it, and they said, no, that testimony is not enough. There has to be some physical evidence. And I think that the Blazier case actually has the best language, because Blazier points out that by saying that you're going to allow a verbal statement to constitute physical evidence, you really expand coverage beyond what could be imagined. Basically, what you're saying is that any time an employee says, oops, I threw the property away, there's going to be coverage.
Now, the trial judge said that Westcom is really distinguishable because the court found no evidence whatsoever, not because the employee's evidence was verbal, but because the fact that it was missing provided no explanation of what happened to it. What's wrong with that distinction?
Because I think the court below blurred the two concepts of physical and what happened to it. And the court did say that that was not, I mean, I can, the court's
page,
quote.
Page 11 of the opinion.
I mean, the court's quote in Westcom was essentially, there is no evidence at all, much less any physical evidence, to show what happened to it, meaning that not only was there not any evidence to show what happened to it, there wasn't any physical evidence to show what happened
to
it.
Well, let's focus on that. Let's talk about the one instance for example, that's contained in the National Grange policy language, which is shortage of inventory on taking inventory. There are, you know, if you have a fully electronically controlled inventory control, then presumably you could end up with a computerized inventory search printed out on hard copy showing a shortage, correct?
Yes.
And that would be physical evidence. According to your side's position, is that right? It'd be a piece of paper, you know, that showed the result of a computerized inventory.
Well, except that is a shortage disclosed on inventory. That's the method of the inventory. I really don't know that I want to address that situation because it's not the issue that's present here.
Well, I'm addressing it.
No, I understand. But
would the printout showing the inventory shortage be physical evidence?
In an instance where it is merely a shortage disclosed on inventory?
That's right.
I don't believe so, because that is the shortage disclosed on inventory.
Well,
there has to be physical evidence of what to show what happened to it.
Maybe I should try it a different way. You know, there are inventories and there are inventories. If you have a mom and pop store, you can have inventory taken by just counting the number of cans of peas on the shelf and finding out that there are cans of peas that are missing, that are unaccounted for. Nothing more. And, you know, the other end of the spectrum is the fully computerized determination of the shortage, which is papered. Now, which one of those, if either, is physical evidence of the shortage?
They are physical evidence of the shortage, but it doesn't meet the provision because it's not physical evidence of what happened to it. All it does is show that there is a shortage. That's the point of the provision, is that the physical evidence has to show what happened to it. So you have to have both physical evidence, and you have to have that physical evidence show what happened to it. I only have 42 seconds left, and I would like to save some time for rebuttal.
Very well. Yes.
May it please the court, Craig Carson is here, and I appreciate the opportunity to represent my client, Elegant Slumming, before this court. I take a step back, and I say that you have to look at the word physical when you apply it to physical evidence, because there's an assumption that is made by the appellant here that somehow that means a description of physical evidence or testimony is not involved. It almost raises philosophical issues. We cited to the court a definition of physical, a very common dictionary definition of physical. And it includes things that you can hear. It includes testimony. And I would ask your honors to look at the Blazier case cited by the appellant. And in that case, the court deals with that very issue. And I think it deals with it differently than I've heard described, and I take a different view than my respected opponent here. What they say at page 11 of that decision is, alert, the applicant under the policy contends that the exclusion might apply even though a witness can testify about the burglary. The answer to Alert's hypothetical really is not in doubt. Just as Ortbal's, and that was one of the employees, testimony about the condition of her office is testimony about physical evidence, testimony about the physical movements of a burglar into and out of a building and about that, about the carrying of the property would be testimony about physical evidence of theft. Fireman Fund agrees with this construction. I don't think you can read that language to say anything other than if you have testimony about physical evidence, it constitutes physical evidence under the policy provision.
Mr. Carswitz,
yes.
What, you know, what is the you know, the overriding purpose of the clause? Is it to obtain reliable evidence, objective evidence, non-biased evidence? Because if that's what it is, those are adjectives that could have been used rather than physical.
Your Honor, the only thing I can say for sure to answer your question is that it was to exclude a circumstance where all you knew was that there was an inventory that was reduced. To me, that's the only thing you can say for sure from that language.
If that's true, then I guess your position would be that you can strike the word physical from that that exclusion, and it wouldn't change the meaning.
Yes, Your Honor.
Ought to be.
Yes, Your Honor, I think that's true. Now, I would also suggest that physical is a much broader term than is being suggested by my respected opponent here. That physical doesn't mean everything but testimony. There is an argument that's being made that somehow there's some common parlance that's the case, and I don't think that's at all
correct. Well, either it means something or it means nothing. If the purpose and the meaning of the exclusion would be the same if the word physical were struck, then doesn't your position come down to the point that the word means nothing?
I think that's correct, Your Honor. I think that's correct. It in the context of how they've written this, it really doesn't add anything. And to the extent that, but it's the extent that we want it to mean anything, it is much broader than what is being suggested.
Well, Mr. Carson, that's one of the things we're always concerned about, are the implications of ruling in favor of one side or the other. Up until the point in time when we had this case, our court has talked about documentary evidence. We've talked about testimonial evidence, and we've talked about tangible and physical evidence somewhat interchangeably. And you see that in the McIntosh case by our court that was cited by your opponent. What's going to happen to those distinctions if we say, as a matter of law, testimonial evidence constitutes physical evidence?
Here are a couple of things I can answer that way. First, what I think would be being said by this court, that under this policy, the way this is written, it includes testimonial evidence. It's a little bit difficult to determine any broader determination than that. Frankly, I don't think suggestions in criminal cases and other places where you talk about those things has any controlling precedent with the use of this language. The true answer to that question is policies ought to be written in a way to say what they mean. And I would suggest that that was not the case here.
The argument we hear on the other side is they put the word in physical for a reason. And if we're just going to read physical out of the policy, that would be contrary to the way we construe contracts, in that if they had meant evidence, they would have simply said evidence. If they meant any evidence, they would have said any evidence. But they've limited the ability to recover to fiscal evidence.
Correct, Your Honor. And I would say in response to that, when they use the word physical, then they need to. We need to look at what the definition of that word is, and that's what Judge Stokes did in this case. And we looked at a standard definition, and it includes things that we can hear.
Well, why wouldn't that be, for instance, if there was a tape recording of a warehouse, something which would demonstrate that someone was in there and taking things out, audible sounds of a theft.
It clearly would be that. Okay.
But it's contemporaneous to the event, as opposed to somebody merely recounting it later.
I cannot disagree with your description of that. That is correct. I will also point out, Your Honor made the comment that there was other things here to prove the theft. And one of those, of course, was the receipt that was signed by the employee. There were also photographs of the area where this took place, which helped describe how this happened, that an employee could have boxes in an area where there are trash boxes and get them confused. So there was even more than that. But certainly the very substantial evidence as to what happened here came from the testimony of the employee.
Can you give me an example of any circumstance where this provision would preclude coverage?
Well, there's one very easy one, and that is what is being described in the Westcom case and the CTCS case, and that is where all you can say is we had 100 widgets one day and we had 50 widgets the next day. Clearly, that's not covered by this policy.
In that instance, you could develop there might be a written inventory, or there might be photographs of the storeroom.
Well, but Your Honor, that would miss is it wouldn't explain what happened to the property, which I think is also part of what this provision requires. You would know again is that there was a loss, and I believe that's what's being tried
That was Mr. Bennett's point, and I apologize to him for not grasping that fully enough. So I think we all agree that what is required, in addition to the fact that something is missing, is why.
Correct.
And the why has to be the subject of what the policy refers to as physical evidence. You argue that physical is a broad enough term to encompass what can be perceived by the senses, what can be heard. But if that's true, then why not describe the evidence as audible evidence or visual evidence? Isn't physical designed to get to something else?
Your Honor, I think it includes all of that. But I think it also includes testimonial evidence. Our position, and I think Judge Stokes' position, is that absolutely falls within the parameter of this. It is a very broad provision, and it doesn't narrow things very much, but that's the provision that they determined to use in this policy. One other thing I would like to address, if I may, we have this specter in the briefing and in the argument here today that, well, then anything may go. Well, that's why we have trials. That's why we have evidence presented to the court and witnesses evaluated. And in fact, in this case, the appellant had that opportunity, if they would wanted to exercise that opportunity. Judge Stokes' opinion did not preclude them from going to trial to raise the issues that they raised in these briefs about the credibility of the witness in this case. They talk about other statements, and we heard that again today from Mr. Bennett. But as you know from reading the record, they decided not to do that. They asked that the Superior Court enter judgment in our favor, so they could then take this legal issue before your honors. But this whole specter that you shouldn't believe this person, I would suggest is not appropriate at this level and is not part of this case. Nothing addressed in the...
Excuse me, Mr. Carson. I'd like to pursue a line of argument that was at least suggested in your brief. I'm not sure it was argued straightforwardly, and that is that in interpreting what the word physical evidence or physical means, you need to view the exclusion from the standpoint of the insured's reasonable expectations. Here, the word physical, which is the source of the problem, is an undefined term.
Correct.
And the word it seems to be chameleon-like. It changes with the time of day, with the context. In those circumstances, where the insurance company uses an undefined term, it cannot be permitted to defeat the reasonable expectations of the insured by having, by basically creating an exclusion that could be narrow, broad, or somewhere in between.
Your Honor, I absolutely agree with that position. It was argued before Judge Stokes, and Judge Stokes decided the case on a different basis, which is why we really didn't develop it here. But I think you're absolutely correct. Any policyholder, even reading that, I'm not sure would know what that means. Certainly they would understand, I think, that it didn't include just inventory loss. But where they had substantial evidence as to what happened, even if that was the description. The example I would like to give...
Well, before you give me the example, I'd just like to know whether there's a doctrine that you're referring to in that suggestion, and then...
You know, there's substantial case law in that area. I am not prepared to cite that here today because, frankly, it wasn't argued.
Could you articulate the doctrine, even though you can't cite the case?
Yes, absolutely. A policyholder has a right to be able to read its policy and creates reasonable expectations as to where there is coverage. And when you look at this, the only thing I believe that policy is telling the policy owner is that I can't bring a claim if all I can show is that there was a shortage of an inventory. I think other than that, if there is proof of what happened, I think, frankly, these fine hairs that we split about physical evidence and what it means and what it doesn't mean is something that no reasonable policyholder is going to be able to determine. So
Wait and look at that for a moment. If you read it the way you just described it, another way of saying it would be, if the inventory is missing, I'm going to have to do better than having somebody come in and testify the inventory was missing. I'm going to need something physical. And yet, what we see in this case is you're saying it's simply enough to have someone come in and say the jewelry's missing.
That's correct, Your Honor. Although I think we have more than that in this case. And I think that, again, the root of that problem traces back to the use of the word, the undefined word, physical. In this case, and a common understanding of the word physical is far broader than something you could hold. It's something you could see. It's something you could hear. It's something you could smell, and it's something that you could listen to. And I think that a common parlance for that is contrary to what they say is the testimonial evidence.
Did you argue below that the different constructions by courts around the country of the meaning of physical in this context in and of itself was sufficient to render this policy language ambiguous and therefore it should be construed against the insured?
Your Honor, I argued below that it was ambiguous and that it should be construed. And part of that was that the courts couldn't even determine what it was. But I think part of it also was what I'm talking about when you ask yourself, what does the word physical mean? And does it mean much broader, or is it an ambiguous term? The court didn't determine the case on that basis, but certainly it was discussed and it was part of the briefing. The only other, unless the court has more questions than that, the only other thing I wanted to address is briefly the attorney's fee issue, and I only have three things to say with respect to that.
Before you do,
yes, Your Honor,
where did that issue come from? There was no, I couldn't find in the record an opinion on that. I couldn't find any statement in either side's brief of what the legal basis for an attorney's fee.
There's a statutory provision, Your Honor, that was cited, a statutory provision that allows for the assessment of attorney's fees for first-party claims on casualty insurance policies. And in any event, the only other things I wanted to say about that were three things. One is we provided all our records to both defense counsel and to the court in connection with the analysis of our claim and our client's claim with regard to that. The second thing I wanted to say was we thought that the court appropriately awarded the attorney's fees. And the last thing I would say is to this court on that subject is the same thing I said to Judge Stokes, and that is whatever is fair is what we are satisfied with.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With respect to the attorney's fees, I think the briefing speaks for itself, and I won't address it. I believe that Mr. Karsnitz has addressed it appropriately. Whatever the court finds is fair is fair. I want to touch on a few things that Mr. Karsnitz said, and one of them was that, well, we could have taken this to trial. Well, you got to look at the exclusion or the limitation. This isn't a you have to show evidence that physical evidence beyond a reasonable doubt or more likely so than not. No, the exclusion, the limitation is all you have to do is present some physical evidence. Once the court determined that verbal testimony is physical evidence, then all of a sudden you have physical evidence that regarding what happened to the missing property. So the exclusion applies. There's no point in having a trial at that point. It doesn't matter whether you believe the person or not. That's the whole point of making it be physical.
I want to be sure I understand you on this. Is it your position that the policy language is not a coverage provision, it's an exclusion?
The way it's worded is a limitation.
Well, what is that?
Which means essentially it's an exclusion, but an exclusion, as set forth in other parts, totally excludes certain portions. A limitation excludes that loss when there is no physical evidence. So,
and the reason I ask that is because construction can be influenced by whether it's a coverage or an exclusion.
Certainly.
You agree that an exclusion is interpreted against the insurer?
Yes, I do. But at the same time, I believe that the court has to give meaning to the word physical. You can't have it just be some or any. Physical is there for a reason.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett.
Okay.
Thank you both for your arguments. The court will take the matter under advisement, and we will adjourn.